Roy Staunton. They were married after appropriate preparations. As a wedding, it was neither a religious ceremony nor a merrymaking. It is best described as a function. Everybody of importance in Boy's world was there, and by clever work on Denise's part, quite a few cabinet ministers from Ottawa were present, and the Prime Minister sent a telegram composed by the most eloquent of his secretaries. Bishop Woodywis married them, being assured that Denise had not been the offending party in her divorce. He demurred even then, but Boy persuaded him, saying to me afterward that diocesan care and rumors of the death of God were eroding the bishop's intellect. The bride wore a ring of unusual size. The best man was a bank president. The very best champagne flowed like the very best champagne under the care of a very good caterer, which is to say, not more than 3 glasses to a guest unless they made a fuss. There was little jollity, but no bitterness, except from David. "Do we kiss the bride?" a middle-aged guest asked him. "Why not?" said he. "She's been kissed oftener than a police court Bible, and by much the same class of people." The guest hurried away and told somebody that David was thinking of his mother. I do not think this was so. Neither David nor Caroline liked Denise, and they hated and resented her daughter, Laureen. Not much attention had been paid to Laureen during the courtship, but she was an element to be reckoned with. She was the fruit of the unsatisfactory marriage with Hornick, who may, perhaps, have had the pox, and at this time she was 13. Adolescence was well advanced in Laureen, and she had large, hard breasts that popped out so close under her chin that she seemed to have no neck. Her body was heavy and short, and her physical coordination was so poor that she tended to knock things off tables that were quite a distance from her. She had bad vision and wore thick spectacles. She already gave rich promise of superfluous hair and sweated under the least stress. Her laugh was loud and frequent, and when she let it loose, spittle ran down her chin, which she sucked back with a blush. Unkind people said she was a half-wit, but that was untrue. She went to a special boarding school where her teachers had put her in the opportunity class, as being more suited to her powers than the undemanding academic curriculum, and she was learning to cook and sew quite nicely. At her mother's wedding, Laureen was in tearing high spirits. Champagne dissolved her few inhibitions, and she banged and thumped her way among the guests, wet-chinned and elated.
"I'm just the luckiest kid in the world today," she whooped. "I've got a wonderful new daddy, my daddy boy. He says I can call him daddy boy. Look at the bracelet he gave me."
In the goodness of her innocent heart, Laureen tried to be friendly with David and Caroline. After all, were they not one family now? Poor Laureen did not know how many strange gradations of relationship the word family can imply. Caroline, who had never had a pleasant disposition, was extremely rude to her. David got drunk and laughed and made disrespectful remarks in an undertone when Boy made his speech in response to the toast to the bride. Rarely is there a wedding without its clown. Laureen was the clown at Boy's second marriage, but it was not until she fell down, champagne or unaccustomed high heels, or both, that I took her into an anteroom and let her tell me all about her dog, who was marvelously clever. In time, she fell asleep, and 2 waiters carried her out to the car. 3. Denise had the normal dislike of a woman for the friends her husband has made before he married her, but I felt she was more than usually severe in my case. She possessed intelligence, conventional good looks, and unusual quality as an intriguer and politician, but she was a woman whose life and interests were entirely external. It was not that she was indifferent to the things of the spirit. She sensed their existence and declared herself their enemy. She had made it clear that she consented to a church wedding only because it was expected of a man in Boy's position. She condemned the church rite because it put women at a disadvantage. All her moral and ethical energy, which was abundant, was directed towards social reform. Easier divorce, equal pay for equal work as between men and women. No discrimination between the sexes in employment. These were her causes, and in promoting them she was no comic strip feminist termagant, but reasonable, logical, and untiring. Boy often assured me that underneath this public personality of hers, there was a shy, lovable kid, pitifully anxious for affection and the tenderness of sex. But Denise did not choose to show this aspect of herself to me. She had a fair measure of intuition, and she sensed that I regarded women as something other than fellow citizens who had been given an economic raw deal because of a few unimportant biological differences. She may even have guessed that I held women in high esteem for qualities she had chosen to discourage in herself. But certainly she did not want me around the Staunton house, and if I dropped in, as had been my habit for 30 years, she picked a delicate quarrel with me, usually about religion. Like many people who are ignorant of religious matters, she attributed absurd beliefs to those who were concerned with them. She had found out about my interest in saints. After all, my books were not easy to overlook if one was in the travel business. The whole notion of saints was repugnant to her, and in her eyes I was on a level with people who believed in teacup reading or social credit. So although I was asked to dinner now and then, when the other guests were people who had to be worked off for some tiresome reason, I was no longer an intimate of the household. Boy tried to smooth things over by occasionally asking me to lunch at his club. He was more important than ever, for as well as his financial interests, which were now huge, he was a public figure, prominent in many philanthropic causes, and even a few artistic ones, as these became fashionable. I sensed that this was wearing on him. He hated committees, but they were unavoidable even when he bossed them. He hated inefficiency, but a certain amount of democratic inefficiency had to be endured. He hated unfortunate people, but, after all, these are one's raw material if one sets up shop as a philanthropist. He was still handsome and magnetic, but I sensed grimness and disillusion when he was at his ease, as he was with me. He had embraced Denise's rationalism, that was what she called it, fervently, and one day, at the York Club, following the publication and varied reviews of my big book on the psychology of myth and legend, he denounced me petulantly for what he called my triviality of mind and my encouragement of superstition. He had not read the book, and I was sharp with him. He pulled in his horns a little and said, as the best he could do in the way of apology, that he could not stand such stuff because he was an atheist. "I'm not surprised," said I. "You created a god in your own image, and when you found out he was no good, you abolished him. It's a quite common form of psychological suicide." I had only meant to give him blow for blow, but to my surprise, he crumpled up. "Don't nag me, Dunny," he said. "I feel rotten. I've done just about everything I've ever planned to do, and everybody thinks I'm a success. And of course I have Denise now to keep me up to the mark, which is lucky, damned lucky, and don't imagine I don't feel it. But sometimes I wish I could get into a car and drive away from the whole damn thing." "A truly mythological wish," I said. "I'll save you the trouble of reading my book to find out what it means. You want to pass into oblivion with your armor on, like King Arthur, but modern medical science is too clever to allow it. You must grow old, boy. You'll have to find out what age means and how to be old. A dear old friend of mine once told me he wanted a god who would teach him how to grow old. I expect he found what he wanted. You must do the same, or be wretched. Whom the gods hate, they keep forever young." He looked at me almost with hatred. "That's the most lunatic, defeatist nonsense I've ever heard in my life," he said. But before we drank our coffee, he was quite genial again. Although I had been rather rough, I was worried about him. As a boy, he had been something of a bully, a boaster, and certainly a bad loser. As he grew up, he had learned to dissemble these characteristics, and to anyone who knew him less well than I, it might have appeared that he had conquered them. But I have never thought that traits that are strong in childhood disappear. They may go underground, or they may be transmuted into something else, but they do not vanish. Very often they make a vigorous appearance after the meridian of life has been passed. It is this, and not senility, that is the real second childhood. I could see this pattern in myself. My boyhood trick of getting off good ones that went far beyond any necessary self-defense and were likely to wound had come back to me in my 50s. I was going to be a sharp-tongued old man as I had been a sharp-tongued boy, and Boy Staunton had reached a point in life where he no longer tried to conceal his naked wish to dominate everybody and was angry and ugly when things went against him. As we neared our 60s, the cloaks we had wrapped about our essential selves were wearing thin. 4. Mrs. Dempster died the year after Boy's second marriage. It came as a surprise to me, for I had a notion that the insane lived long, and had made preparations in my will for her maintenance if I should die before her. Her health had been unimpaired by the long and wretched stay in the city asylum, and she had been more robust and cheerful after her move to the country. But I think my foolish talk about Paul broke her. After that well-meant piece of stupidity, she was never simple again. There were drugs to keep her artificially passive, but I mistrusted them, perhaps ignorantly, and asked that so far as possible she be spared the ignominy of being stunned into good conduct. This made her harder to care for and cost more money, so she spent some of her time in fits of rage against me as the evil genius of her life, but much more in a state of grief and desolation. It wore her out. I could not talk to her, but sometimes I looked at her through a little spy hole in her door, and she grew frailer and less like herself as the months passed. She developed physical ailments, slight diabetes, a kidney weakening, and some malfunctioning of the heart, which were not thought to be very serious and were controlled in various ways. The doctors assured me, with the professional cheeriness of their kind, that she was good for another 10 years. But I did not think so, for I was born in Deptford, where we were very acute in detecting when someone was breaking up, and I knew that was what was happening to her. Nevertheless, it was a surprise when I was called by the hospital authorities to say she had had a serious heart seizure and might have another within a few hours. I had known very little of life without Mrs. Dempster, and despite my folk wisdom about breaking up, I had not really faced the fact that I might lose her. It gave me a clutching around my own heart that scared me, but I made my way to the hospital as quickly as I could, though it was some hours after the telephone call when I arrived. She was in the infirmary now, and unconscious. The outlook was bad, and I sat down to wait, presumably for her death. But after perhaps 2 hours, a nurse appeared and said she was asking for me. As it was now some years since she had seen me without great distress of mind, I was doubtful about answering the call, but I was assured it would be all right, and I went to her bedside. She looked very pale and drawn, but when I took her hand, she opened her eyes and looked at me for quite a long time. When she spoke, her speech was slack and hardly audible. "Are you Dunstable Ramsay?" she said. I assured her. Another long silence. "I thought he was a boy," said she, and closed her eyes again. I sat by her bed for quite a long time, but she did not speak. I thought she might say something about Paul. I sat for perhaps an hour, and then to my astonishment, the hand I held gave a little tug, the least possible squeeze. It was the last message I had from Mrs. Dempster. Soon afterward, her breathing became noisy, and the nurses beckoned me away. In half an hour, they came to tell me she was dead. It was a very bad night for me. I kept up a kind of dismal stoicism until I went to bed, and then I wept. I had not done such a thing since my mother had beaten me so many years before. No, not even in the worst of the war. And it frightened and hurt me. When at last I fell asleep, I dreamed frightening dreams, in some of which my mother figured in terrible forms. They became so intolerable that I sat up and tried to read, but could not keep my mind on the page. Instead, I was plagued by fantasies of desolation and wretchedness so awful that I might as well not have been 60 years old, a terror to boys and a scholar of modest repute, for they crushed me as if I were the feeblest of children. It was a terrible invasion of the spirit. And when at last the rising bell rang in the school, I was so shaken I cut myself shaving, vomited my breakfast half an hour after I had eaten it, and in my first class spoke so disgracefully to a stupid boy that I called him back afterward and apologized. I must have looked stricken, for my colleagues were unusually considerate towards me, and my classes were uneasy. I think they thought I was very ill, and I suppose I was, but not of anything I knew how to cure. I had arranged for Mrs. Dempster's body to be sent to Toronto, as I wanted it to be cremated. An undertaker had it in his care, and the day after her death I went to see him. "Dempster," he said. "Yes, just step into room C." There she was, not looking very much like herself, for the embalmer had been generous with the rouge. Nor can I say that she looked younger or at peace, which are the two conventional comments. She just looked like a small, elderly woman, ready for burial. I knelt, and the undertaker left the room. I prayed for the repose of the soul of Mary Dempster, somewhere and somehow unspecified, under the benevolence of some power unidentified, but deeply felt. It was the sort of prayer that supported all the arguments of Denise Staunton against religion, but I was in the grip of an impulsion that it would have been spiritual suicide to deny. And then I begged forgiveness for myself, because, though I had done what I imagined was my best, I had not been loving enough, or wise enough, or generous enough in my dealings with her. Then I did an odd thing that I almost fear to record, Headmaster, for it may lead you to dismiss me as a fool, or a madman, or both. I had once been fully persuaded that Mary Dempster was a saint, and even of late years I had not really changed my mind. There were the three miracles, after all. Miracles to me, if to no one else. Saints, according to tradition, give off a sweet odor when they are dead. In many instances it has been likened to the scent of violets. So I bent over the head of Mary Dempster and sniffed for this true odor of sanctity. But all I could smell was a perfume, good enough in itself, that had obviously come out of a bottle. The undertaker returned, bringing a cross with him. Seeing me kneel, he had assumed that the funeral would be of the sort that required one. He came upon me sniffing.
"Chanel number 5," he whispered. "We always use it when nothing is supplied by the relatives. And perhaps you have noticed that we have padded your mother's bosom just a little. She had lost something there during the last illness, and when the figure is reclining, it gives a rather wasted effect."
He was a decent man, working at a much abused but necessary job, so I made no comment except to say that she was not my mother.
"I'm so sorry. Your aunt," said he, desperate to please and be comforting, but not intimate.
"No, neither mother nor aunt," I said, and as I could not use so bleak and inadequate a word as friend to name what Mary Dempster had been to me, I left him guessing. The following day I sat quite alone in the crematory chapel as Mary Dempster's body went through the doors into the flames. After all, who else remembered her? 5. She died in March. The following summer I went to Europe and visited the Bollandists, hoping they would pay me a few compliments on my big book. I'm not ashamed of this. Who knew better than they if I had done well or ill? And whose esteem is sweeter than that of an expert in one's own line? I was not disappointed. They were generous and welcoming as always. And I picked up one piece of information that pleased me greatly. Padre Blason was still alive, though very old, in a hospital in Vienna. I had not meant to go to Vienna, though I was going to Salzburg for the festival, but I had not heard from Blason for years and could not resist him. There he was, in a hospital directed by the Blue Nuns, propped up on pillows, looking older but not greatly changed, except that his few teeth were gone. He even wore the deplorable velvet skullcap, rakishly askew over his wild white hair. He knew me at once.
"Ramsay," he crowed as I approached. "I thought you must be dead. How old you look! Why, you must be all kinds of ages. What years? Come now, don't be coy. What years?"
"Just over the threshold of 61," I said.
"Aha! A patriarch. You look even more, though. Do you know how old I am?"
"No, you don't, and I am not going to tell. If the sisters find out, they think I am senile. They wash me too much now. If they knew how old I am, they would flay me with their terrible brushes, flay me like St. Bartholomew. But I will tell you this much. I shall not see 100 again.
How much over that, I tell nobody.
But it will be discovered when I am dead. I may die any time. I may die as we are talking.
Then I shall be sure to have the last word, eh?
Sit down. You look tired.
You have written a fine book. Not that I have read it all, but one of the nuns read some of it to me. I made her stop because her English accent was so vile she desecrated your elegant prose, and she mispronounced all the names. A real murderer.
How ignorant these women are!
assassins of the spoken word.
For a punishment, I made her read a lot of Le Juif Errant to me. Her French is very chaste, but the book nearly burned her tongue. So very anti-clerical, you know? And what it says about the Jesuits. What evil magicians, what serpents. If we were one scruple as clever as Eugène Sue thought, we should be masters of the world today. Poor soul, she could not understand why I wanted to hear it, or why I laughed so much. Then I told her it was on the index, and now she thinks I am an ogre disguised as an old Jesuit. Well, well, it passes the time. How is your fool, saint?
My what?
Don't shout. My hearing is perfectly good. Your fool, saint, your mad woman who dominates your life. I thought we might get something about her in your book, but not a word. I know, I read the index first. I always do. All kinds of saints, heroes, and legends, but no fool saint. Why?
I was surprised to hear you call her that, because I haven't heard that particular expression for 30 years. The last man to use it about Mary Dempster was an Irishman, and I told him of my conversation with Father Regan so long ago.
Ah, Ramsay, you are a rash man. Imagine asking a village priest a question like that.
But he must have been a fellow of some quality. Not all the Irish are idiots. They have a lot of Spanish blood, you know. That he should know about fool saints is very odd. But do you know that one is to be canonized quite soon?
Bertila Boscardin, who did wonders, truly wonders, during the First World War with hospital patients. Many miracles of healing and heroic courage during air raids. Still, she was not quite a classic fool saint. She was active, and they are more usually passive. Great lovers of God, with that special perception that Saint Bonaventura spoke of as beyond the power of even the wisest scholar.
Father Regan assured me that fool saints are dangerous. The Jews warn against them particularly, because they are holy meddlers and bring ill luck.
Well, so they do, sometimes, when they are more fool than saint.
We all bring ill luck to others, you know, often without in the least recognizing it. But when I talk of a fool saint, I do not mean just some lolloping idiot who babbles of God instead of talking filth, as they usually do.
Remind me about this Mary Dempster.
So I did remind him, and when I had finished, he said he would think about the matter. He was growing weary, and a nun signaled to me that it was time to leave.
"He is a very dear and good old man," she told me. "But he does so love to tease us. If you want to give him a treat, bring him some of that very special Viennese chocolate. He finds the hospital diet a great trial. His stomach is a marvel. Oh, that I might have such a stomach, and I am not even half his massive age."
So next day I appeared with a lot of chocolate, most of which I gave to the nun to be rationed to him. I did not want him to gorge himself to death before my eyes, but the box I gave him was one of those pretty affairs with a little pair of tongs for picking out the piece one wants.
"Aha, St. Dunstan and his tongs," he whispered. "Keep your voice down, St. Dunstan, or all these others will want some of my chocolate, and it probably would not be wholesome for them. Oh, you saintly man!"
I suppose a bottle of really good wine could not be got past the nuns. They dole out a thimbleful of some terrible belly vengeance they buy very cheap on their infrequent feast days.
Well, I have been thinking about your fool saint, and what I conclude is this. She would never have got past the Bollandists, but she must have been an extraordinary person, a great lover of God, and trusting greatly in his love for her.
As for the miracles, you and I have looked too deeply into miracles to dogmatize. You believe in them, and your belief has colored your life with beauty and goodness. Too much scientizing will not help you.
It seems far more important to me that her life was lived heroically. She endured a hard fate, did the best she could, and kept it up until at last her madness was too powerful for her. Heroism in God's cause is the mark of the saint, Ramsay. Not conjuring tricks. So on All Saints' Day, I do not think you will do anything but good by honoring the name of Mary Dempster in your prayers.
By your own admission, you have enjoyed many of the good things of life because she suffered a fate that might have been yours. Though a boy's head is hard, Ramsay. Hard, as you, being a schoolmaster, must surely know. You might just have had a nasty knock. Nobody can say for sure. But your life has been illuminated by your fool saint, and how many can say so much? We talked a little further of friends we shared in Brussels, and then suddenly he said,
"Have you met the devil yet?"
"Yes," I replied. "I met him in Mexico City. He was disguised as a woman, an extremely ugly woman, but unquestionably a woman."
"Unquestionably?"
"Not a shadow of a doubt possible." "Really, Ramsay, you astonish me. You are a much more remarkable fellow than one might suppose, if you will forgive me for saying so. The devil certainly changed his sex to tempt St. Anthony the Great, but for a Canadian schoolmaster? Well, well, one must not be a snob in spiritual things. From your certainty, I gather the devil tempted you with success?" "The devil proved to be a very good fellow. He suggested that a little compromise would not hurt me. He even suggested that an acquaintance with him might improve my character."
"I find no fault with that.
The devil knows corners of us all of which Christ himself is ignorant. Indeed, I am sure Christ learned a great deal that was salutary about himself when he met the devil in the wilderness. Of course, that was a meeting of brothers. People forget too readily that Satan is Christ's elder brother, and has certain advantages in argument that pertain to a senior. On the whole, we treat the devil shamefully, and the worse we treat him, the more he laughs at us. But tell me about your encounter." I did so, and he listened with a great show of prudery at the dirty bits. He sniggered behind his hand, rolling his eyes up until only the whites could be seen. He snorted with laughter. When I described Liesel and the beautiful Faustina in the dressing room, he covered his face with his hands, but peeped wickedly between his fingers. It was a virtuoso display of clerical Spanish modesty. But when I described how I had wrung Liesel's nose until the bone cracked, he kicked his counterpane and guffawed until a nun hurried to his bedside, only to be repelled with full-arm gestures and hissing.
"Oh-ho, Ramsay! No wonder you write so well of myth and legend. It was St. Dunstan seizing the devil's snout in his tongs 1,000 years after his time. Well done! Well done! You met the devil as an equal, not cringing or frightened or begging for a trashy favor. That is the heroic life, Ramsay. You are fit to be the devil's friend, without any fear of losing yourself to him."
On the third day, I took farewell of him. I had managed to arrange for some chocolate to be procured when he needed more, and as a great favor, the nuns took 6 bottles of a good wine into their care, to be rationed to him as seemed best.
"Goodbye," he cried cheerfully. "We shall probably not meet again, Ramsay. You are beginning to look a little shaky."
"I have not yet found a god to teach me how to be old," I said. "Have you?"
"Shh, not so loud. The nuns must not know in what a spiritual state I am. Yes, yes, I have found him, and he is the very best of company. Very calm, very quiet, but gloriously alive. We do, but he is. Not in the least a proselytizer or a careerist, like his sons," and he went off into a fit of giggles.
I left him soon after this, and as I looked back from the door for a last wave, he was laughing and pinching his big copper nose with the tiny chocolate tongs.
"God go with you, St. Dunstan," he called.
He was much in my mind as I tasted the pleasures of Salzburg, and particularly so after my first visit to the special display called Schöne Madonnen in the exhibition rooms in the cathedral. For here, at last, and after having abandoned hope and forgotten my search, I found the little Madonna I had seen during my bad night at Passchendaele. There she was, among these images of the Holy Mother in all her aspects, collected as examples of the wood and stone carver's art, and drawn from churches, museums, and private collections all over Europe. There she was, quite unmistakable, from the charming crown that she wore with such an air, to her foot set on the crescent moon. Beneath this moon was what I had not seen in the harsh light of the flare, the globe of the earth itself, with a serpent encircling it and an apple in the mouth of the serpent. She had lost her scepter, but not the divine child, a fat, reserved little person who looked out at the world from beneath half-closed eyelids. But the face of the Madonna, was it truly the face of Mary Dempster? No, it was not, though the hair was very like. Mary Dempster, whose face my mother had described as being like a pan of milk, had never been so beautiful in feature, but the expression was undeniably hers, an expression of mercy and love, tempered with perception and penetration. I visited her every day during my week in Salzburg. She belonged, so the catalogue told me, to a famous private collection and was considered a good, though late, example of the Immaculate Conception aspect of the Madonna figure. It had not been considered worthy of an illustration in the catalogue, so when my week was up, I never saw it again. Photography in the exhibition was forbidden, but I needed no picture. She was mine forever. 6. The mysterious death of Boy Staunton was a 9 days' wonder, and people who delight in unsolved crimes, for they were certain it must have been a crime, still talk of it. You recall most of the details, Headmaster, I'm sure. At about 4 o'clock on the morning of Monday, November 4, 1968, his Cadillac convertible was recovered from the waters of Toronto Harbor, into which it had been driven at a speed great enough to carry it, as it sank, about 20 feet from the concrete pier. His body was in the driver's seat, the hands gripping the wheel so tightly that it was very difficult for the police to remove him from the car. The windows and the roof were closed, so that some time must have elapsed between driving over the edge and the filling of the car with water. But the most curious fact of all was that in Boy's mouth the police found a stone, an ordinary piece of pinkish granite about the size of a small egg, which could not possibly have been where it was unless he himself or someone unknown had put it there. The newspapers published columns about it, as was reasonable, for it was local news of the first order. Was it murder? But who would murder a well-known philanthropist, a man whose great gifts as an organizer had been of incalculable value to the nation during the war years? Now that Boy was dead, he was a hero to the press. Was it suicide? Why would the president of the Alpha Corporation, a man notably youthful in appearance and outlook, and one of the two or three richest men in Canada, want to kill himself? His home life was of model character. He and his wife, the former Denise Hornick, a figure of note in her own right as an advocate of economic and legal reform on behalf of women, had worked very closely in a score of philanthropic and cultural projects. Besides, the newspapers thought it now proper to reveal, his appointment by the Crown to the office of Lieutenant Governor of Ontario was to have been announced within a few days. Was a man with Boy Staunton's high concept of service likely to have killed himself under such circumstances? Tributes from distinguished citizens were many. There was a heartfelt one from Joel Surgener, within a few hundred yards of whose lifeline mission the death occurred, a mission that the dead man had supported most generously. You wrote one yourself, Headmaster, in which you said that he had finely exemplified the school's unremitting insistence that much is demanded of those to whom much has been given. His wife was glowingly described, though there was little mention of a former marriage, which ended with the death of the first Mrs. Staunton, née Leola Cruikshanks, in 1942. In the list of the bereaved, Loreen took precedence over David, now 40, a barrister and a drunk, and Caroline, now Mrs. Beeston Bastable and mother of one daughter, also Caroline. The funeral was not quite a state funeral, though Denise tried to manage one. She wanted a flag on the coffin, and she wanted soldiers, but it was not to be. However, many flags were at half-staff, and she did achieve a very fine turnout of important people, and others who were important because they represented somebody too important to come personally. It was agreed by everyone that Bishop Woodywis paid a noble tribute to Boy, whom he had known from youth, though it was a pity poor Woodywis mumbled so now. The reception after the funeral was in the great tradition of such affairs, and the new house Denise had made Boy build, in the most desirable of the suburbs, was filled even to its great capacity. Denise was wonderfully self-possessed and ran everything perfectly, or almost perfectly. There was one thing in which she did not succeed. She approached me after she had finished receiving the mourners, if that is the right way to describe the group who were now getting down so merrily to the scotch and rye. And, "Of course you'll write the official life," said she. "What official life?" I asked, startled and clumsy. "What official life do you suppose?" she said, giving me a look that told me very plainly to brace up and not be a fool. "Oh, is there to be one?" I asked. I was not trying to be troublesome. I was genuinely unnerved, and with good cause. "Yes, there is to be one," she said, and icicles hung from every word. "As you knew Boy from childhood, there will be a good deal for you to fill in before we come to the part where I can direct you." "But how is it official?" I asked, wallowing in wonderment. "I mean, what makes it official? Does the government want it or something?" "The government has had no time to think about it," she said. "But I want it, and I shall do whatever needs to be done about the government. What I want to know now is whether you are going to write it or not." She spoke like a mother who is saying, "Are you going to do what I tell you or not?" to a bad child. It was not so much an inquiry as a flick of the whip. "Well, I'll want to think it over," I said. "Do that. Frankly, my first choice was Eric Roop. I thought it wanted a poet's touch. But he can't do it, though considering how many grants Boy wangled for him, I don't know why. But Boy did even more for you. You'll find it a change from those saints you're so fond of." She left me angrily. Of course I did not write it. The heart attack I had a few days later gave me an excellent excuse for keeping free of anything I didn't want to do. And how could I have written a life of Boy that would have satisfied me and yet saved me from murder at the hands of Denise? And how could I, trained as a historian to suppress nothing, and with the Bollandist tradition of looking firmly at the shadow as well as the light, have written a life of Boy without telling all that I have told you, Headmaster, and all I know about the way he died? And even then, would it have been the truth? I learned something about the variability of truth, as quite rational people see it, from Boy himself, within an hour of his death. You will not see this memoir until after my own death, and you will surely keep what you know to yourself. After all, you cannot prove anything against anyone. Nor was Boy's manner of death really surprising to anyone who knows what you now know about his life. It was like this. 7. Magnus Isengrim did not bring his famous display of illusions to Canada until 1968. His fame was now so great that he had once had his picture on the cover of Time as the greatest magician in history. The autobiography sold quite well here, though nobody knew that its subject, or its author, was a native. It was at the end of October he came to Toronto for 2 weeks. Naturally, I saw a good deal of him and his company. The beautiful Faustina had been replaced by another girl, no less beautiful, who bore the same name. Liesel, now in early middle age and possessed of a simian distinction of appearance, was as near to me as before, and I spent all the time I could spare with her. She and Blazon were the only people I have ever met with whom one resumed a conversation exactly where it had been discontinued, whether yesterday or 6 years earlier. It was through her intercession, perhaps it would be more truthful to call it a command, that I was able to get Isengrim to come to the school on the Sunday night in the middle of his fortnight's engagement, to talk to the boarders about hypnotism. Schoolmasters are without conscience in exacting such favors. He was a huge success, of course, for though he had not wanted to come, he was not a man to scamp anything he had undertaken. He paid the boys the compliment of treating them seriously, explaining what hypnotism really was and what its limitations were. He emphasized the fact that nobody can be made to do anything under hypnotism that is contrary to his wishes, though of course people have wishes that they are unwilling to acknowledge, even to themselves. I remember that this concept gave trouble to several of the boys, and Isengrim explained it in terms and with a clarity that suggested to me that he was a much better informed man than I had supposed. The idea of the hypnotist as an all-powerful demon, like Svengali, who could make anybody do anything, he poo-pooed. But he did tell some amusing stories about odd and embarrassing facets of people's personalities that had made their appearance under hypnotism. Of course, the boys clamored for a demonstration, but he refused to break his rule of never hypnotizing anyone under 21 without written consent from their parents. He did not add that young people and children are difficult hypnotic subjects because of the variability of their power of concentration. However, he did hypnotize me, and made me do enough strange things to delight the boys without robbing me of my professional dignity. He made me compose an extemporary poem, which is something I had never done before in my life, but apparently it was not bad. His talk lasted for about an hour, and as we were walking down the main corridor of the classroom building, Boy Staunton came out of the side door of your study, headmaster. I introduced them, and Boy was delighted.
"I saw your show last Thursday," he said. "It was my stepdaughter's birthday, and we were celebrating. As a matter of fact, you gave her a box of sweets."
"I remember perfectly," said Isengrim. "Your party was sitting in C-21 through 25. Your stepdaughter wears strong spectacles and has a characteristic laugh."
"Yes, poor Laureen. I'm afraid she became a bit hysterical. We had to leave after you sawed a man in two. But may I ask you a very special favor? How did your brazen head know what was implied in the message it gave to Ruth Tillman? That has caused some extraordinary gossip."
"No, Mr. Staunton, I cannot tell you that. But perhaps you will tell me how you know what was said to Mrs. Tillman, who sat in F-32 on Friday night, if your party came to the theater on Thursday."
"Mightn't I have heard it from friends?"
"You might, but you did not. You came back to see my exhibition on Friday night because you had missed some of it by reason of your daughter's overexcitement. I can only assume my exhibition offered something you wanted. A great compliment. I appreciated it, I assure you. Indeed, I appreciated it so much that the head decided not to name you and tell the audience that your appointment as Lieutenant Governor would be announced on Monday. I am sure you understand how much renunciation there is in refusing such a scoop. It would have brought me wonderful publicity, but it would have embarrassed you, and the head and I decided not to do that."
"But you can't possibly have known. I hadn't had the letter myself more than a couple of hours before going to the theater. I had it with me, as a matter of fact."
"Very true, and you have it now, inside right-hand breast pocket. Don't worry, I haven't picked your pocket. But when you lean forward, however slightly, the tip of a long envelope made of thick, creamy paper can just be seen. Only governments use such ostentatious envelopes, and when a man so elegantly dressed as you are bulges his jacket with one of them, it is probably... You see, there is an elementary lesson in magic for you. Work on it for 20 years, and you may comprehend the brazen head." This took Boy down a peg. The good-humored, youthful chuckle he gave was his first step to get himself on top of the conversation again.
"As a matter of fact," he said, "I've just been showing it to the headmaster, because, of course, I'll have to resign as chairman of the Board of Governors, and I was just coming to talk to you about it, Dunny."
"Come along, then," I said. "We were going to have a drink." I was conscious already that Boy was up to one of his special displays of charm. He had put his foot wrong with Isengrim by asking him to reveal the secret of an illusion. It was unlike him to be so gauche. But I suppose the excitement about his new appointment blew up his ego a little beyond what he could manage. It seemed to me that I could already see the plumed, cocked hat of a lieutenant governor on his head. Isengrim had been sharp enough with him to arouse hostility, and Boy loved to defeat hostility by turning the other cheek, which is by no means a purely Christian ploy, as Boy had shown me countless times. Isengrim further topped him by the little bit of observation about the letter, which had made Boy look like a child who is so besotted by a new toy that it cannot let the toy out of its grasp. Boy wanted a chance to right the balance, which of course meant making him master of the situation. It was clear to me that one of those sympathies, or antipathies, or at any rate unusual states of feeling, had arisen between these two, which sometimes lead to falling in love, or to sudden warm friendships, or to lasting and rancorous enmities, but which are always extraordinary. I wanted to see what would happen, and my appetite was given the special zest of knowing who Isengrim really was, which Boy did not, and perhaps would never learn. It was like Boy to seek to ingratiate himself with the new friend by treating the old friend with genial contempt. When the three of us had made our way to my room at the end of the top-floor corridor, my old room, which I have always refused to leave for more comfortable quarters in the newer buildings, he kicked the door open and entered first, turning on the lights and touring the room as he said, "Still the same old rat's nest. What are you going to do when you have to move? How will you ever find room anywhere else for all this junk? Look at those books. I'll bet you don't use some of them once a year." It was true that several of the big volumes were spread about, and I had to take some of them out of an armchair for Isengrim, so I was a little humbled. But Isengrim spoke. "I like it very much," said he. "I so seldom get to my home, and I have to live in hotel rooms for weeks and months on end. Next spring I go on a world tour. That will mean something like 5 years of hotels. This room speaks of peace and a mind at work. I wish it were mine." "I wouldn't say old Dunny's mind was at work," said Boy. "I wish all I had to do was teach the same lessons every year for 40 years. "You are forgetting his many and excellent books, are you not?" said Isengrim. Boy understood that he was not going to get what he wanted, which cannot have been anything more than a complicity with an interesting stranger, by running me down, so he took another tack. "You mustn't misunderstand if I am disrespectful towards the great scholar. We're very old friends. We come from the same little village. In fact, I think we might say that all the brains of Deptford, past, present, and doubtless to come, are in this room right now." For the first time in Boy's company, Isengrim laughed. "Might I be included in such a distinguished group?" he asked. Boy was pleased to have gained a laugh. "Sorry, birth in Deptford is an absolute requirement." "Oh, I have that already. It was about my achievements in the world that I had doubt." "I've looked through your autobiography. Loreen asked me to buy a copy for her. I thought you were born somewhere in the far north of Sweden." "That was Magnus Isengrim. My earlier self was born in Deptford. If the autobiography seems to be a little high in color, you must blame Ramsay. He wrote it."
"Dunny, you never told me that."
"It never seemed relevant," said I. I was amazed that Paul would tell him such a thing, but I could see that he, like Boy, was prepared to play some high cards in this game of topping each other.
"I don't remember anybody in the least like you in Deptford. What did you say your real name was?"
"My real name is Magnus Isengrim. That is who I am, and that is how the world knows me. But before I found out who I was called Paul Dempster, and I remember you very well. I always thought of you as the rich young ruler."
"And are you and Dunny old friends?"
"Yes, very old friends. He was my first teacher of magic. He also taught me a little about saints, but it was the magic that lingered. His specialty as a conjurer was eggs, the Swami of the omelet. He was my only teacher till I ran away with a circus."
"Did you? You know I wanted to do that. I suppose it is part of every boy's dream."
"Then boys are lucky that it remains a dream. I should not have said a circus. It was a very humble carnival show. I was entranced by Willard the Wizard. He was so much more skillful than Ramsay. He was quite clever with cards and a very neat pickpocket. I begged him to take me, and was such an ignorant little boy. Perhaps I might even call myself innocent, though it is a word I don't like, that I was in ecstasy when he consented. But I soon found out that Willard had two weaknesses, boys and morphia. The morphia had already made him careless, or he would never have run the terrible risk of stealing a boy. But when I had well and truly found out what traveling with Willard meant, he had me in slavery. He told me that if anybody ever found out what we did together, I would certainly be hanged. But he would get off, because he knew all the judges everywhere. So I was chained to Willard by fear. I was his thing and his creature, and I learned conjuring as a reward. One always learns one's mystery at the price of one's innocence, though my case was spectacular. But the astonishing thing is that I grew to like Willard, especially as Morphia incapacitated him for his hobby and ruined him as a conjurer. It was then he became a wild man.
Then he was Le Solitaire des Forêts, I asked.
That was even later. His first decline was from conjurer to wild man, essentially a geek.
Geek, said Boy.
That is what carnival people call them. They are not an advertised attraction, but word that a geek is in a back tent is passed around quietly, and money is taken without any sale of tickets. Otherwise, the humane societies make themselves a nuisance. The geek is represented as somebody who simply has to have raw flesh, and especially blood. After the Spieler has lectured terrifyingly on the psychology and physiology of the geek is given a live chicken. He growls and rolls his eyes, then he gnaws through its neck until the head is off, and he drinks the spouting blood. Not a nice life, and very hard on the teeth, but if it is the only way to keep yourself in Morphia, you'd rather geek than have the horrors. But geeking costs money. You need a live chicken every time, and even the oldest, toughest birds cost something. Before Willard got too sick even to geek, he was geeking with worms and garter snakes when I could catch them for him. The rubes loved it. Willard was something even the most disgusting brute could despise. There was trouble with the police at last, and I thought we would do better abroad. We had been over there quite a time, Ramsay, before you and I met in the Tyrol, and by then Willard was in very poor health, and Le Solitaire des Forêts was all he could manage. I doubt if he even knew where he was. So that is what running away with a circus was like, Mr. Staunton. Why didn't you leave him when he was down to geeking? Shall I answer you honestly? Very well, then. It was loyalty. Yes, loyalty to Willard, though not to his geeking or his nasty ways with boys. I suppose it was loyalty to his dreadful, inescapable human need. Many people feel these irrational responsibilities and cannot crush them. Like Ramsay's loyalty to my mother, for instance. I am sure it was an impediment to him, and certainly it must have been a heavy expense, but he did not fail her. I suppose he loved her. I might have done so if I had ever known her. But you see, the person I knew was a woman unlike anybody else's mother, who was called Hoor by people like you, Mr. Staunton.
I really don't remember, said Boy. Are you sure?
Quite sure. I have never been able to forget what she was or what people called her. Because, you see, it was my birth that made her like that. My father thought it his duty to tell me, so that I could do whatever was possible to make it up to her. My birth was what robbed her of her sanity. That sometimes happened, you know, and I suppose it happens still. I was too young for the kind of guilt my father wanted me to feel. He had an extraordinary belief in guilt as an educative force. I couldn't stand it. I cannot feel guilt now. But I can call up in an instant what it felt like to be the child of a woman everybody jeered at and thought a dirty joke, including you, the rich young ruler. But I am sure your accent is much more elegant now. A lieutenant governor who said hoor would not reflect credit on the crown, would he? Boy had plenty of experience in being baited by hostile people, and he did not show by a quiver how strange this was to him. He prepared to get the attack into his own hands.
I forget what you said your name was.
Isengrim continued to smile, so I said, He's Paul Dempster. This time it was my turn for surprise.
Who may Paul Dempster be? Asked Boy.
Do you mean to say you don't remember the Dempsters? In Deptford? The Reverend Amasa Dempster? No. I don't remember what is of no use to me, and I haven't been in Deptford since my father died. That's 26 years.
You have no recollection of Mrs. Dempster?
None at all. Why should I?
I could hardly believe he spoke the truth, but as we talked on, I had to accept it as a fact that he had so far edited his memory of his early days that the incident of the snowball had quite vanished from his mind.
But had not Paul edited his memories so that only pain and cruelty remained? I began to wonder what I had erased from my own recollection. We had drinks, and were sitting as much at ease as men can amid so many strong currents of feeling. Boy made another attempt to turn the conversation into a realm where he could dominate.
How did you come to choose your professional name? I know magicians like to have extraordinary names, but yours sounds a little alarming.
Don't you find that a disadvantage?
No, and I did not choose it. My patron gave it to me. He turned his head towards me, and I knew that the patron was Liesel. It comes from one of the great northern beast fables, and it means wolf. Far from being a disadvantage, people like it. People like to be in awe of something, you know. And my magic show is not ordinary. It provokes awe, which is why it is a success. It has something of the quality of Ramsay's saints, though my miracles have a spice of the devil about them. Again, my patron's idea. That is where you make your mistake. You have always wanted to be loved. Nobody responds quite as we would wish, and people are suspicious of a public figure who wants to be loved. I have been wiser than you. I chose a wolf's name. You have chosen forever to be a boy. Was it because your mother used to call you Pidgey Boy Boy, even when you were old enough to call my mother Whore?
How in God's name did you know that?
Nobody in the world now living knows that. Oh yes, two people know it, myself and Ramsay. He told me, many years ago, under an oath of secrecy.
I never did any such thing,
I shouted, outraged. Yet even as I shouted, a doubt assailed me. But you did, or how would I know? You told me that to comfort me once, when the rich young ruler and some of his gang had been shouting at my mother. We all forget many of the things we do, especially when they do not fit into the character we have chosen for ourselves. You see yourself as the man of many confidences, Ramsay. It would not do for you to remember a time when you told a secret. Dunstan Ramsay, when did you cease to be Dunstable? A girl renamed me when I had at last broken with my mother. Liesel said it made me one of the twice-born. Had you thought that we are all three of the company of the twice-born? We have all rejected our beginnings and become something our parents could not have foreseen. I can't imagine your parents foreseeing that you would become a theorizer about myth and legend, said Isengrim. Hard people, I remember them clearly. Hard people, especially your mother. Wrong, said I, and I told him how my mother had worked and schemed and devised a nest to keep him alive, and exulted when he decided to live. She said you were a fighter, and she liked that. Now it was his turn to be disconcerted. Do you mind if I have one of your cigars? He said. I do not smoke cigars, but the box he took from a shelf on the other side of the room might easily be mistaken for a humidor, rather a fine one. But as he took it down and rather superciliously blew dust from it, his face changed. He brought it over and laid it on the low table around which our chairs were grouped. What's this? He asked. It is what it says it is, said I. The engraving on the silver plaque on the lid of the box was beautiful and clear, for I had chosen the script with care. Requiescat in pace. Mary Dempster, 1888 through 1959. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. We looked at it for some time. Boy was first to speak.
Why would you keep a thing like that with you?
A form of piety, a sense of guilt unexpiated. Indolence. I've always been meaning to put them in some proper place, but I haven't found it yet.
Guilt, said Isengrim.
Here it was. Either I spoke now, or I kept silence forever. Dunstan Ramsay counseled against revelation, but Fifth Business would not hear. Yes, guilt. Staunton and I robbed your mother of her sanity, and I told them the story of the snowball.
Too bad, said Boy. But if I may say so, Dunny, I think you've let the thing build up into something it never was. You unmarried men are terrible fretters. I threw the snowball, at least you say so, and for argument's sake let that go. And you dodged it. It precipitated something which was probably going to happen anyhow. The difference between us is that you've brooded over it, and I've forgotten it. We've both done far more important things since. I'm sorry if I was offensive to your mother, Dempster. But you know what boys are. Brutes, because they don't know any better. But they grow up to be men.
Very important men. Men whom the crown delighteth to honor, said Isengrim with an unpleasant laugh.
Yes, if you expect me to be diffident about that, you're wrong.
Men who retain something of the brutish boy, even, said I.
I don't think I understand you.
Fifth Business insisted on being heard again. "Would this jog your memory?" I asked, handing him my old paperweight. "Why should it? An ordinary bit of stone. You've used it to hold down some of the stuff on your desk for years. I've seen it 100 times. It doesn't remind me of anything but you." "It is the stone you put in the snowball you threw at Mrs. Dempster," I said. "I've kept it because I couldn't part with it. I swear I never meant to tell you what it was. But boy, for God's sake, get to know something about yourself. The stone in the snowball has been characteristic of too much you've done for you to forget it forever."
"What I've done?
Listen, Dunny, one thing I've done is to make you pretty well off for a man in your position. I've treated you like a brother, given you tips nobody else got, let me tell you. And that's where your nice little nest egg came from, your retirement fund you used to whine about." I hadn't thought I whined, but perhaps I did. "Need we go on with this moral bookkeeping?" I said. "I'm simply trying to recover something of the totality of your life. Don't you want to possess it as a whole, the bad with the good? I told you once you'd made a god of yourself, and the insufficiency of it forced you to become an atheist. It's time you tried to be a human being. Then maybe something bigger than yourself will come up on your horizon."
"You're trying to get me. You want to humiliate me in front of this man here. You seem to have been in cahoots with him for years, though you never mentioned him or his miserable mother to me. Your best friend and your patron and protector against your own incompetence. Well, let him hear this, as we're dealing in ugly truths. You've always hated me because I took Leola from you. And I did. It wasn't because you lost a leg and were ugly. It was because she loved me better." This got me on the raw, and Dunstable Ramsay's old inability to resist a cruel speech when one occurred to him came uppermost. "My observation has been that we get the women we deserve, King Candolis," I said, "and those who eat jam before breakfast are cloyed before bedtime." "Gentlemen," said Isengrim, "deeply interesting though this is, Sunday nights are the only nights when I can get to bed before midnight, so I shall leave you." Boy was all courtesy at once. "I'm going too. Let me give you a lift," said he. Of course, he wanted to blackguard me to Isengrim in the car. "Thank you, Mr. Staunton," said Isengrim. "What Ramsay has told us puts you in my debt, for 80 days in paradise, if for nothing in this life. We shall call it quits if you will drive me to my hotel." I lifted the casket that contained Mary Dempster's ashes. "Do you want to take this with you, Paul?" "No thanks, Ramsay. I have everything I need." It seemed an odd remark, but in the emotional stress of the situation, I paid no heed to it. Indeed, it was not until after the news of Boy's death reached me next morning that I noticed my paperweight was gone. 8. Because of the way he died, the consequent police investigations, and the delays brought about by Denise's determination to make the most of the nearly official funeral, Boy was not buried until Thursday. The Saturday evening following, I went to see Isengrim's Soiree of Illusions, as he now called it, at its last performance, and though I spent much of the evening behind the scenes with Liesel, I went into the front of the house during the Brazen Head of Friar Bacon. Or rather, I hid myself behind the curtains of an upper box so that I could look down into the auditorium of our beautiful old Royal Alexandra Theatre and watch the audience. Everything went smoothly during the collecting and restoration of borrowed objects, and the faces I saw below me were the usual studies in pleasure, astonishment, and, always the most interesting, the eagerness to be deceived mingled with resentment of deception. But when the head was about to utter its 3 messages to people in the audience, and Isengrim had said what was to come, somebody in the top balcony shouted out, "Who killed Boy Staunton?" There was murmuring in the audience, and a hiss or two, but silence fell as the head glowed from within, its lips parted, and its voice, Liesel's voice, slightly foreign and impossible to identify as man's or woman's, spoke. "He was killed by the usual cabal, by himself first of all, by the woman he knew, by the woman he did not know, by the man who granted his inmost wish, and by the inevitable fifth, who was keeper of his conscience and keeper of the stone. I believe there was an uproar. Certainly Denise made a great to-do when she heard of it. Of course, she thought the woman he knew must be herself. The police were hounded by her and some of her influential friends, but that was after Isengrim and his soiree of illusions had removed by air to Copenhagen, and the police had to make it clear that they really could not investigate impalpable offenses, however annoying they might be. But I knew nothing about it, because it was there, in that box, that I had my seizure and was rushed to the hospital, as I was afterward told by a foreign lady. When I was well enough to read letters, I found one, a postcard to my horror, that read, "Deeply sorry about your illness, which was my fault, as much as most such things are anybody's fault. But I could not resist my temptation, as I beg you not to resist this one. Come to Switzerland, and join the Basso and the Brazen Head. We shall have some high old times before the Five make an end of us all. Love, L.V." And that, Headmaster, is all I have to tell you. St. Gallen, 1970.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Fifth Business, Book 1 of the Deptford Trilogy. Written by Robertson Davies. Narrated by Mark Vitor. Executive Producer Christina Harkar. Producer Mike Charzik. Engineered and directed by Julia Farhat. Production Coordinator Kat Lambrix. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1970 by Robertson Davies. Production copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.